From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are Dan Rabib, columnist for Newsday, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive editor. Welcome, Dan and Steve.
Nice to be here. My pleasure.
Here are the issues. In his first address to a joint session of Congress, U.S. President Joe Biden pitched an ambitious spending plan that includes ensuring universal pre-K and an extra 4 years of education for millions of Americans. Biden also discussed his goal of engaging with other nations and taking a leadership role on the world stage as this week marks 100 days of Biden's U.S. presidency. Also, the FBI has carried out searches at the home and office of Rudy Giuliani, who was Donald Trump's personal lawyer. India's coronavirus death toll has topped 200,000 as it continues to be mired in a catastrophic surge of the disease. Meanwhile, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, ended a 10-day pause on the use of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine. The CDC also issued new guidelines this week on recommendations for outdoor mask wearing. We'll look at what the new guidelines mean. And we'll discuss the findings of a new and controversial report released this week by the human rights advocacy group Human Rights Watch. The report accuses the Israeli government of committing crimes of apartheid and persecution against Palestinians. Those are the issues. And gentlemen, let's get started. Dan, I'll start with you. What would you say are some of the biggest takeaways from President Biden's address to Congress?
Well, in addition to all the specifics of what President Biden was proposing to Congress, in that, frankly, he wants to spend a lot of money to improve things in the United States, I was struck by the overall tone, the message of what he was trying to say this past Wednesday. In fact, he gave a preview. It's kind of a tradition before the president addresses Congress. In the afternoon, the president meets with some of the top journalists in this country, including, frankly, the anchors of the TV network newscasts. And it turns out that he told them that he was thinking about meetings he had with foreign leaders such as the Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Chinese President Xi Jinping. And he became convinced, Joe Biden said, that the story of this moment is whether democracy can stand up to all the challenges of the current era. And he said that it's been a troubling question. Can democratic countries like the United States actually succeed, or will there be autocratic countries? And so he mentions China and Russia, for instance, that are trying to become the leading countries on earth. And he told Congress that, in effect, this is the test we have, and we have to spend money to improve the United States, including an agenda that would try to stamp out racial inequities and improve education in this country. And the Republican response on the whole was that should be left up to the people, not the government. So Biden is trying to bring back big government. It's in part a reaction to the 4 years of Donald Trump, but also Biden and the folks we call the liberals in this country are trying to use the fact that they have a majority in the House of Representatives, and they just slightly control a majority in the Senate. And so Democrats and liberals see an opportunity.
Steve, President Biden's American Family Plan calls for $1.9 trillion of spending. I can't help but think that all taxpayers will feel the brunt of this type of spending. Is this a feasible plan?
The numbers don't necessarily seem to be able to add up, but one of the things that Biden has proposed is spending $80 billion to shore up the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, which is the tax collection agency for the country. And the idea is if more tax collection assets were put toward that, the bounty that would be brought in from cracking down on tax loopholes and looking at various different other tax issues would bring in close to $1 trillion of taxes that have not been collected but could be collected on Americans and American companies. So that's one part of the plan. He's also been steadfast since his campaign in saying that, yes, he's going to raise taxes, but he is not going to raise taxes on any families making less than $400,000 a year. So that puts Biden's tax plan to the top 1 to 2% of Americans plus corporations. And I felt like he was talking directly to the American people because of the lack of an audience in House chamber gave him that opportunity to speak directly to the American people in a conversational way about his plans. And I feel like he came off a lot more like Joe Biden would come across than any other president in a much larger filled room. He was not playing to the room, he's playing to the American people and to the television cameras. So his steadfastness as far as tax dollars and who's going to be taxed more is going to be key to his being able to fulfill the promises of being able to spend the kind of money that he's proposing. And neither the tax proposals nor the spending proposals are going to get many, if any, of the opposing party, of the Republican Party, to come over the aisle and support his policies.
Steve and Kim, everything is so divisive these days. And so you have the same set of facts or you have a speech by the president. And the Democrats and the Republicans, when asked about it in the hours and day that followed, Democrats said it was terrific that President Biden was speaking to what Americans really care about. And Republicans say that he is totally violating his pledge to unite the country. And Republicans say that he is just trying to attack corporations. He wants to raise taxes. Republicans, when you ask them, concede that, sure, the plan officially is only trying to raise taxes on rich people and corporations, but that filters down. And in the end, every American, according to the Republicans, will end up paying more for everything and will have inflation. And in addition, again, is the big issue. Big government. Can you trust government to solve all these problems? Because government tends to waste money. We'll have to see how much of this even passes Congress. As Steve said, there was a very limited number of senators and House members who were there because of COVID-19. But in the interviews afterward, you had a sense that even the Democrats might not be fully united. The Republicans probably will be united in opposing the Biden agenda. So we wonder if all of it will pass.
And Senator Tim Scott, who's a Republican from South Carolina, he gave the rebuttal speech to Biden's address. And he highlighted that, you know, we're not moving ahead unified, as you pointed out, Dan and Steve. So your thoughts on Senator Scott's response?
One of the things that Senator Scott is correct in saying that Biden's proposals are not moving very many Republican senators and members of the House of Representatives to his side. But what Biden is trying to do is tout policies that are popular with the American people. The polling shows that spending on education, spending on pre-kindergarten education of 3 and 4 and 5 year olds is a popular plan. That spending money on various different issues that he is out there as far as his spending plans are all popular. And the metaphor of the relatively empty House chamber during his speech says that he's not playing to the politicians. Biden is trying to go beyond them and make his direct plea to the American people and hoping that those popular policies will stick with them and the popularity of them will then bring the Republican members of the Senate and the House of Representatives along with the rest of the people. So he's trying to play beyond the politicians and try to get his policies accepted by the people.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it, Steve, as though public opinion and public pressure can sway members of Congress to vote for things that originally they wouldn't want to. And you're right. As the negotiations unfold in the coming months, there could be pressure on Republicans to say yes to some of this spending, despite their initial claim that it all looks like socialism to them.
That's a good point. And another aspect of Biden's address, he's dealing with a new challenge with gun violence. And I know he has a list of demands for Congress and police reform. So where do you think the Biden administration stands in this area?
It's going to be difficult for the president to get bipartisan support for many of his policies because of the way politics is in the United States. But again, as far as guns are concerned, the idea of tighter regulations and closing various loopholes on gun registration, as well as banning various different types of assault weapons, all have popular support among the people of the United States. And Biden, again, is trying to jump over Congress in trying to make those appeals to the people who will then, in his mind, then pressure Republicans to join with Biden.
Well, the president did mention inequities in America, and he mentioned gun violence. So those are two issues that, you know, I know when the world looks at the United States, often, you know, many people around the globe are so surprised that many Americans want to own guns. They love the Second Amendment to the Constitution that gives Americans the right to own guns. But then we end up having a very high rate of gun violence and murders and some mass killings this year that have shocked the country. In addition to that are the incidents of police opening fire and killing or grievously wounding Black American men in all sorts of incidents that are now being examined by federal authorities. And so Biden's government is taking a stand very different from Donald Trump's administration, where Biden's Department of Justice is looking into what the police say in Minneapolis, where George Floyd was killed, and of course, the officer Derek Chauvin was found guilty of murder, and whether what the police have been doing there is wrong and maybe even racist. These are issues that frankly don't resonate with all Americans. They are divisive, they are controversial, but Biden and his vice president, Kamala Harris, of course, the first African-American vice president in this country, they find these issues to be absolutely vital. They say less in the way of inequities in America, that's going to lead to a more peaceful and prosperous country.
And as we move on to our next topic, I just wanted to wrap this one up with a little historic trivia. President Biden, in reference to Vice President Kamala Harris and Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, said, quote, "No president has ever said those words from this podium. It's about time, Madam Speaker, Madam Vice President," unquote. And as we move on to look at the FBI carrying out searches at the home and office of Rudy Giuliani, he was former President Donald Trump's personal lawyer. Steve, what do we know about this raid?
The only way a search warrant like this is carried out is if a federal judge takes a look at the evidence that is presented and agrees that a search warrant is needed. Now, Rudy Giuliani used to be one of the top prosecutors in the country. So for a search warrant to be issued for the former president's lawyer, the amount of evidence that had to be presented to a judge had to be so high and so much that the judge had to serve a search warrant says a lot about what the government has as far as evidence regarding Rudy Giuliani. It sounds like they have something serious.
And Dan, where is this coming from and where do you see this heading to?
It was fascinating to learn this past week that at least some in the FBI wanted to investigate Giuliani, yes, to raid his offices and his home while Donald Trump was still president. And Giuliani, of course, has been very close with Donald Trump. And Giuliani was one of the leaders of the campaign, including legal filings, to try to prove that there was massive fraud in the American election this last November. So according to Giuliani, Trump won the election. Of course, is what Trump says. But this investigation is apparently about what Giuliani was doing in Ukraine and regarding Ukraine, the possibility that he was acting as an unregistered agent of Ukrainian politicians, wealthy Ukrainians, perhaps involved in many issues and investments. You know, we still don't know exactly whether it's all about politics, but a lot of this became public when we found out that at Donald Trump's behest, when Trump was still president, Giuliani was going to Ukraine and trying to dig up evidence that Biden and his son, Hunter Biden, were doing something wrong that had to do with Ukraine taking money wrongfully. That was the allegation made by some Republicans. So here's the bottom line as of now. People who support Trump and Rudy Giuliani say this is the Democratic Party, now that it is in power, taking revenge against Donald Trump's personal lawyer, against Giuliani. They say that is a wrongful act, raiding Giuliani's home, trying to humiliate him. Again, I think we'll have to find out if any charges are actually filed and whether conceivably Giuliani or anyone else close to Donald Trump, or as some Democrats say, who knows, maybe former President Trump actually have to face some legal charges. As of now, it's an investigation.
One note, this is the second time federal authorities have carried out a search warrant for a personal attorney of Donald Trump's. Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to tax evasion and other charges. That search happened, I believe, in 2018. So again, it shows that there is something there that federal prosecutors, federal authorities are looking to see whether or not Giuliani was doing things illegally in perhaps allegedly lobbying for Ukraine.
That's a good sum up of that particular issue. And we will take a short break. And when we come back, we'll discuss the latest in the fight against COVID-19 and the surge of coronavirus in India. And we'll look at a controversial report that accuses Israel of apartheid. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive editor. Well, here in the U.S., the FDA and the CDC have ended a 10-day pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine due to the vaccine causing blood clots in some people. Dan, have scientists determined that the benefits outweigh the risk in getting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which is just one shot?
Yeah, well, that is the bottom line. Just one shot, easier to transport. So the Johnson & Johnson vaccine seemed to be a very helpful breakthrough when at first it was approved by U.S. health authorities for emergency use. And then came the suspicion. First, we heard about it in Europe, and then over here in the U.S., it was confirmed that a few people are getting blood clots and some women died in the United States. But how many cases were there of blood clots that could be linked with these anti-COVID-19 shots, these vaccinations? About 2 out of every 1 million. And so that's why American health authorities said, if you consider how thousands of lives could be saved by this vaccination, this vaccine should be used again. It's no surprise that many members of the public are hesitant and say they'd rather instead use the two that are still being used in a widespread way, the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine. But even there, you get some Americans who say that because they are the results, those two vaccines are the result of bioengineering that involves the RNA that gets your DNA to do something. Some people are fearing that. And so bottom line is opinion polls show more than 20% of Americans say they're never going to get vaccinated. They don't think it's necessary and they don't want to take the risk.
Also, Steve, the CDC says that fully vaccinated Americans no longer need to wear masks outdoors, with some exceptions, such as being in large crowds. So can we look at this as we're slowly getting back to what we knew as normal, or that mask wearing may be here for a much longer time, since you will still need a mask even if you are vaccinated?
I think it's both, Kim, because one, the idea of taking off masks outside does signal that whatever the new normal is going to be is in sight. However, keeping masks and the need to continue to wear masks inside sends a signal that COVID is still going to be around during the winter months. And when everybody goes back inside and out from the outside, and when the weather turns colder, we're still going to be dealing with COVID and trying to knock it down, wearing masks inside and trying to deal with the entire situation, not just here in the United States, but worldwide.
Let's keep in mind that in the United States, this is often state by state, county by county, city by city. They read advice from the national or federal health authorities. But it was kind of exciting to hear on Thursday morning, if this is realistic, that New York City's mayor announced that New York City is ready to reopen completely on July 1st. So starting just before our big Independence Day holiday, July 4th, maybe New York will allow crowds to gather for the fireworks and then have a normal summer with concerts and theater. And well, we'll just have to see. But that seems to be the trend that many local officials in the United States have had it with shutdowns. They think the vaccinations are making things a lot safer and that the economy needs a big restart.
Yes, that is so true. And then looking on the other side of the world, we have India, who continues to grapple with an unrelenting second wave of COVID-19, and some neighboring countries in South Asia are seeing their own surges in case numbers. Also, amid criticism that the U.S. response to India's COVID-19 crisis has been slow, President Biden said his administration is sending a whole range of critical assistance to the country. So, Steve, why is this criticism there?
Most of the criticism surrounds the United States' decision to buy vaccines and, I won't say hoard the vaccines, but certainly use the United States' financial power in buying plenty of vaccines for Americans, as well as there are criticisms that the United States has not approved the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is used for the most part throughout the rest of the world and is one of the vaccines that is being used to distribute to very, very poor countries and other countries that need vaccines. The United States has been under criticism for basically not taking their surplus vaccine supply and donating it to the rest of the world. Joe Biden has explained, first, we need to vaccinate all Americans, and all Americans who want a vaccine, then ship the rest of the vaccine supply out to the rest of the world. The situation in India is quite serious, and there's a lot of concern that already variants from India have already started to be detected in other parts of the world, including the United States. So getting the situation in India under control is something that is a priority for not just the United States, but for the rest of the world.
With just a few minutes left in the show, I wanted to move on to our last topic. A controversial report released this week by the human rights advocacy group Human Rights Watch accuses the Israeli government of committing crimes of apartheid and persecution against Palestinians. Dan, what do you make of this report?
Well, Human Rights Watch has always been critical of Israeli government policies, especially since 1967, the Six-Day War, when Israel captured the West Bank from Jordan, as well as other territories. And so the West Bank is very much the focus of, you know, how do Israeli authorities behave? And Human Rights Watch, as I say, consistently is critical of Israel. But you could criticize Human Rights Watch for putting a lot of emphasis on this small country of less than 10 million people and how it has behaved in a situation that, according to Israelis, they never wanted back in 1967. But since then, the Israeli presence there, which is usually called an occupation, though parts of the West Bank are just run by a Palestinian authority, the occupation has gone on for nearly 55 years, and Israelis say they're doing their best to cope with the security problem. There were suicide bombers who came into the Israeli territory and blew up people. And Israel also defends itself as saying about 25% of Israeli citizens are not Jewish. They're Arabs, and they have, at least officially, all the usual civil rights of any Israeli citizen. They vote. There are Arab political parties. There is an Arab member of Israel's Supreme Court. And so Israel rejects the notion that in any way it engages in apartheid, but they say Israel is the Jewish state for the Jewish people, just like Hungary is for Hungarian people and Belgium is for Belgian people. But indeed, minorities have to be protected. Immigrant rights have to be protected. Human Rights Watch says Israel has failed at all this. Israel still says it is the best democracy in the Middle East, even if, of course, there are flaws in any democracy. By the way, none of this is going to lead to the United States to cut off aid to Israel. There are controversies. Some progressives in the U.S. would like to limit aid to Israel or how Israel can spend its military aid. But I have no sign that Israel and the U.S. instead this past week have been talking about how to handle the Iran nuclear issue and try to see if the U.S. and Israeli governments can possibly be eye to eye on that. But I would say the U.S. and Israel are still firm allies.
And Steve, I'll give you the last word on this.
The biggest thing I think to note here is that the Israeli-Palestinian issue is not very high on President Biden's agenda so far. He is much more focused, as far as foreign policy is concerned, on dealing with China, Russia, and getting back into the Iran nuclear deal, as well as getting back into the Paris climate deal.
And we'll have to end on that note. Thanks to our panelist, Dan Rabib, columnist for Newsday, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive editor. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.